It is January 11th, 2012. This is an interview with Mr. Merle McMorrow in Fargo, North Dakota. The interviewer is Stephanie Manassas. Mr. McMorrow, can you please tell me a little bit about where you were born and your family?
I was born in Hanginson, North Dakota, which is about 70 miles southwest of here. And I lived there for 2 years, and then my parents moved to Breckenridge, Minnesota, which is about 50 miles south of here. My dad got a job with the Great Northern Railroad in 1925, and I stayed in Breckenridge all through high school, left after that, and never went back home again. Went into service and then came home from service, went to college and got married and so forth.
What did your father do for the Great Northern Railroad?
He was a laborer, and at that time all the steam engines were still in use and they required coal, so at the Great Northern Roundhouse he unloaded carloads of coal.
Okay. And what date and year were you born?
April 22nd, 1923.
1923. So you graduated from high school in 1941?
You know your math, don't you?
I try pretty hard. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
Well, I had seven altogether. One died at birth, about 2 months old. The other one was 4 years old. And I still have two sisters and one brother living.
Okay. So there were eight of you in the family, and then two of your siblings passed away at a young age.
Yes.
Okay. Where did you fall in the lineup in terms of what number child?
I was the oldest.
The oldest. Okay. So tell me about what happened after you graduated from high school in Breckenridge.
Well, I worked for the Wilton County Highway Department that summer, and then in the fall, I came out of the local theater down there in Breckenridge and went over to shoot a game of pool. Everybody was gathered around the radio, and I asked what happened. They said Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor. That was December 7th, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I was listening to the radio, and I said, "Where's Pearl Harbor?" And they said, "It's out in the Hawaiian Islands." Well, I thought, why are we so concerned about that? That's so far away, it'll never bother us. But as we discussed it in the next week or two, I decided to enlist in the service. And I was told at the draft board that they have so many men at age 21 and 20, they're going to have to draft them before I could get in. So I went down to Glenwood, Minnesota, and took a sheet metal course with the NYA, National Youth Administration. And I was through with that in April. So I went out to Bremerton, Washington. It's the government shipyard called the Puget Sound Navy Yard. And I worked on ships that were coming back from Pearl Harbor for repair. Those that could travel under their own power came in and were first in line for repair because they had crews for those ships. As soon as completion of repair, they could go back out to sea rather than building new ships and then training a crew. So I worked there until December. Got a little homesick and also was concerned that the Marines at the front gate of the Navy Yard, you had to go through security to get in the yard. I always got strange looks from them, like maybe you're 4F or unfit for military duty or using the shipyard as an excuse to get deferment. So I decided to go home and enlist in the Air Corps. I went down to Minneapolis on December 8th, 1942, and he said they needed a draft release from my draft board out in Bremerton, Washington. So I wrote for that. Nowadays, you just send a fax and get it back the same day, but I didn't get the release back until December 24th, the afternoon of Christmas Eve. And so I stayed home over Christmas and went back to Minneapolis with this release. And they said, sorry, we closed all enlistments on December 15th at midnight. So then I went back home and I volunteered for the paratroops and went through Fort Snelling in Minnesota and was sent to Camp Toccoa, Georgia, about the middle of March. They were coming up with a new airborne division. It was something new at that time. The 101st Airborne had been formed, and the 82nd Airborne formed. So now they were going to form the 17th Airborne Division. So we went through basic training during the summer. September 8th, we went down to Fort Benning, Georgia, to be sent through 4 weeks of jump training. And we completed that near the end of September. Came back to Camp McCall, North Carolina, for some additional training, nighttime jumps and field operations. And we were completed with that by the first of the year of 1944. So we were sent to Tennessee for maneuvers. And at that time, the entire division was there, 17th. But at that same time in Italy, January 22nd, the invasion near Anzio took place. The 82nd Airborne had jumped in North Africa and then came into Sicily and were coming up the boot of Italy, and Churchill decided by maybe invading further north from the lower part of Italy, they could trap the Germans in a pocket there. Well, this Anzio invasion came off on January 22nd. Anzio's about 35 miles southeast of Rome. And the general that was in charge of the invasion got inland about 12 miles and then stopped, and he was going to wait for replacements. Well, during that same period, the Germans had reserve troops around Rome, and they sent the reserve troops down to the Anzio area, and that invasion sort of became a stalemate. They were 12 miles in and probably 20 miles wide, and both sides are losing a lot of men. So the U.S. military was looking for replacements to replace the men that were lost. And they, at that time, they pulled all the paratroopers out of the 17th Airborne, which was still in Tennessee, and brought us back to Camp McCall and formed the 517th combat team with this group. The combat team consisted of three battalions of infantry, a battalion of artillery, and a company of engineers. So the middle of May, we left for Italy, and a week before we arrived at Anzio, the Americans had broken out of the stalemate and headed for Rome. And so instead of going to Anzio, we landed in Naples on May 30th, 1944. And the Americans had captured Rome by June 5th, 1944, a day before the invasion in Normandy on June 6th. So the battle in Italy no longer got priority on supplies and other things. And we spent 3 weeks north of Rome, Germans were retreating up to, I guess they called it the Gustav Line. It was a line for further resistance that the Germans were going to use as a means to stop any advance any further north in Italy. So after 3 weeks of fighting in Italy, we'd left Naples and gone up to Città di Vinci, which is north of Rome, and then went inland from there. And we were there for 3 weeks, and in that 3 weeks, I think we had 17 killed and a number of wounded. But the 442nd came in to relieve us. That's the Japanese-American Nisi combat team. And we were pulled back to Frascati, which is about 15 miles southeast of Rome. And we were scheduled to jump into southern France. Initially, we were supposed to jump in southern France at the same time the combat teams and the divisions from England jumped into Normandy, and we're going to attempt to trap the Germans. But there weren't enough planes or ships to pull off both invasions simultaneously. So we went into southern France on August 15th of 44. And there were three divisions that came in, considered the 7th Army. Three divisions came in to the shores around Saint-Tropez and north of my...
of Nice, or...?
Nice, yeah.
Yep.
North of Nice. And we jumped inland a ways and and the name skipped me right now, but
Saint Biarritz, or no, not Saint Biarritz. Marseille, was it Marseille?
Well, yeah, we were near Marseille, but Saint-Tropez and a number of those cities along the Saint. Nope, I can't think of them right now. But anyway, it was about 18 miles back from the coast.
Okay.
And our purpose of the jump was to prevent any reinforcements coming down to oppose the three divisions coming in by landing craft at the shore. And the Germans had that area pretty well protected. The Nice airport had all kinds of blockhouses that were used for opposing any incoming forces. And they also had a long, about 3,000-foot wall built along the beach to prevent easy access. And then the three divisions went up the Rhone Valley to attempt to trap Germans that the Normandy people were pushing back. And from that time on, our objective was to prevent any Germans coming over the Maritime Alps from Italy to attack the flank of the three divisions going up the Rhone Valley. So that was pretty well concluded by November, end of November of 44. And we were pulled back to Nice at that time and sent up to Marmelin-le-Grand. And the British and the American 101st and the American 82nd Airborne Division was just coming back from Market Garden, the invasion up in Holland and that area. And you've probably heard The Bridge Too Far, the book and the movie. Well, there was, Americans were supposed to capture one bridge, the 101st, and the 82nd would capture another bridge, and the British were supposed to capture the bridge up to the north, and they failed to capture theirs. But had we gotten those three bridges, you could have gotten across the Rhine and into Germany. So they were going to attack from the north and tie up with the troops coming from Normandy. But the British didn't capture their bridge, so there has been a book written called The Bridge Too Far, and there's a movie also by the same name. So that was a failure. And
now, where was this bridge exactly?
Well, it was up in Holland.
Okay.
And trying to think of the town. But anyway, they didn't capture, the British didn't capture their bridge, so that meant the operation was a failure, so to speak. And the 101st was brought back to Mormelon and Reims area, and the 82nd brought there too, and we came up to Mormelon because the 17th Airborne, in the meantime, had completed their training. They were in England, and they were going to come over to Belgium, and we were supposed to join them again. And we thought we would be there for the winter, get resupplied, get replacements for the men that were lost, and just get new clothing and everything else we needed. And we were, the talk was that the war will be over by Christmas. In fact, I think Eisenhower had a bet with Montgomery, British general, that one said it would be over by Christmas and the other one said it wouldn't. But on December 16th, the Germans attacked through Belgium and in the Ardennes, which was where they attacked in 1940. And the only replacements or surplus troops that Eisenhower had was the 82nd, the 101st Airborne. So he sent the two divisions into Belgium, not knowing which one was going to go where. The 101st went to, as they got closer to the where the action was, Eisenhower sent the 101st into Bastogne because there were seven roads that led in and out, and winter conditions were such that the only way that German tanks could travel was on these roads. And if we could hold Bastogne, we would prevent the Germans moving any further west. They were trying to get to Antwerp because that's where all the American supplies were at that time, gasoline and food and everything else. So their objective was to get to Antwerp and Liège. And if we could hold them long enough, they wouldn't make it because they had a limited supply of fuel for their tanks. And they had counted on capturing some of our supply depots that had fuel there. And that would permit them to go on to complete their objective. But the longer we could keep them from moving, the more fuel they burned of what they had. And it wasn't long, and the Muir River, I think, is about where they ran out of fuel for some of the tanks and had to abandon them. But that battle lasted until about the end of January, 25th, I think, is for us. And there were 19,000 Americans killed and 81,000 wounded, I guess. So we got surrounded in Bastogne for 3-4 days, and Patton came up from the south to open it up. But the weather was so bad that our planes could not fly. And finally, on the 26th of December, the sky cleared like it is today, and sun was shining. And the cargo planes brought in food and ammunition. We were very low on ammunition, and we didn't have any food for 2 days or so. So they dropped food to us and ammunition and wool socks and what we called mud packs, because our boots were freezing. A lot of people were getting frozen feet, or trench foot, they called it, where the foot freezes and just cracks open on the bottom. And then as soon as that sky was clear like that, they started attacking German tanks and so forth too, and had a field day just knocking out German equipment. Our medical team had been captured. They didn't know we were surrounded, and they were coming into Bastogne, and the German patrol captured all the doctors and nurses and so forth that were coming up with supplies. And so on the 26th, when they brought in supplies by parachute, they also came in with gliders, and medical people were also on the gliders, the nurses and doctors and medical supplies. So on the 25th, we were relieved and sent down to Alsace-Lorraine.
This is the 25th of December or January?
January 25th.
Okay.
Of 45.
Okay.
And the day before, the terrible North Dakota blizzard. But we were happy to get out of there. And we thought we were going back to maybe Mormelon or even back somewhere down south. But we were sent to Alsace-Lorraine and spent till March 15th. We were brought back to Mormelon and received the presidential citation. And from there, on April 1st, which was an Easter Sunday, I remember, and it was also the time that Okinawa was invaded in the Pacific. But April 1st, we were sent to Dusseldorf, right on the Rhine River, and we moved into German houses, nice and warm and clean, and it was ideal. We stayed there from April 1st to April 22nd, which was my birthday, and I had a picture taken on the Rhine River. I thought I was getting pretty old by that time, 22 years old. From there, we headed south, and the rumor was that the Germans were going to make a one last stand in the redoubt, they called it, a forested area down in Bavaria. And as we headed south, we got as far as Munich, and we heard that the Germans had surrendered. So we spent a couple of days there processing Germans coming out of the mountains, and the old men and children, they were told to go to Munich to get discharged, and the SS and the Nazi stormtroopers, they were kept and taken into prison camp somewhere. And we got down to into Bavaria, and Hitler's Eagle's Nest was down there, and everybody got put up in chalets in the mountains, and it was a wonderful 6 weeks we spent down there hunting deer and fishing in the mountain streams. The fish weren't biting. We threw a hand grenade in the river, and that would stun the trout, and they'd come floating to the top, and then we'd flip a coin to see who would go out into that icy water to retrieve the fish. But we stayed there until first part of July, and then came back to Epinal, France, and they were breaking up the 101st Airborne Division, and those with 85 points were sent home for discharge. Those with military time in Europe had an option of either being sent to Japan, or if they had enough points, they could be sent home, or they could stay in Germany on occupation duty. And to earn points, you had to get so many points for decorations, so many if you were married, so many if you had number of children, so many for months of service, so many for months of service overseas. And you added all that up, and if we got to 85, then you could go home for discharge. For those that decided, even though they didn't have enough points, they were willing to go to Japan, they got halfway home, the atomic bomb was dropped, and the war was over, and those on the high seas went on home and were discharged. But I, along with a number of others, went to Berlin on occupation duty, and we were there from the first part of July until December 3rd, when we left for home, and got to New York around the middle of the month, and were processed through Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, and then went over to camp in Wisconsin for discharge. And I got home Christmas morning, 1945.
Wow, that must have been a nice gift for you and your family.
Well, I came home, I expected to see all kinds of people at the depot, you know, and the well-wishers and the people happy because you were home. Well, I got on the train in St. Paul, Minnesota, Christmas Eve. I was the only one on the train. And the train whistled through these towns. I could see the farmhouses with Christmas decorations, Christmas trees. I got to Breckenridge, and the train master threw my duffel bag out on the top of the platform there, brick platform at the depot. The train whistled a couple times and was gone. So I picked up my bag and headed home. It was a light snow falling, and I got home just as my dad was leaving for work, about 5 o'clock in the morning. And I laid across the bed and wondered if I'd made the right decision to, because it seemed like all my friends were gone now. We'd been together for 3 years and had a close relationship. And then suddenly I come home and everybody's a stranger, and they're not too concerned about what happened. And later in the day I ran into a lady that said, now that the war's over, maybe we can get butter again. And another lady said, well, hopefully now that the war is over, we can get silk stockings. That was all it meant to them, was butter and silk stockings. And I went back to my job out in the shipyard, and where I'd been before I went into service, because they guaranteed you a job when you got back, and your old job for that matter. Well, the fellow I'd worked with, he said, it's too bad the war ended as soon as it did. If it had lasted another 6 months, I could have had my house paid for. So to him, it meant bonus checks and overtime and so forth. So I was disillusioned for a while. It took a year to get over that, those dumb civilians that had no concern for anything but their butter stockings and overtime pay. So I spent about 6 months out there. My high school girlfriend was out there. We then...
In Washington.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bremerton, Washington. Then we went down to Los Angeles and were married. Came back to Breckenridge in July of 45 and registered at the University of Minnesota, but they said they couldn't take any students until spring because they had 38,000 and had room for no more. So I wasn't going to wait. I decided if I wait that long, I'd probably get involved in some work somewhere and then never get to school. So I registered at NDSU, and they said, sure, we'll start November, or October 1st. Polio was pretty prevalent at that time, and they thought it was due to crowds gathering in the heat of summer. So they delayed school that year until October 1st. I went through the summers, finished in 3 years, and went out to Bismarck, North Dakota, to work for Department of Interior.
So you started school at NDSU in October of 1946?
Right.
And you got married when?
June 12, 1946.
In California?
At Los Angeles.
And what was your high school girlfriend doing out in Washington? Was she waiting for you? Or?
No, she was at Bremerton. She worked in the department at the shipyard that supplied food for the shipyard cafeterias. And she knew she'd come home for Christmas, so I saw her at Christmas time. But she only had so much time at home that she had to go back to Bremerton, I think a few days after Christmas. I told her I'd be out later, and I went out January 13th.
Now, so did she initially go out with you before you enlisted?
No, she was still in school. Okay. She was a sophomore when I graduated.
Okay, so she went to Bremerton when you were already in the military overseas.
Right.
Okay. Let's step back a little bit. This has been really helpful. Tell me more about when the 3 or 4 days when you were isolated, that was in January of 45 in Bastogne, right?
Yes, but it wasn't January.
Was it December?
Yeah, it was around Christmas time.
Okay.
See, December 26th, the skies cleared, and that's when we got food and ammunition, and the fighter planes were coming in to strafe tanks and other German equipment. So we were surrounded from about December 23rd to December 26th. And Patton came up from the south with the 4th Armored Division and opened up that area. I also saw the 4 men that came, the German, under a white flag, that were going to demand our surrender. There was a major, a captain, and 2 enlisted men. And they came down this road waving a white flag, and of course everything stopped then as far as any fighting. And we thought they were coming to surrender, but they came to ask for our surrender since we were surrounded. So our captain of the 327th Infantry Regiment kept the 2 enlisted men and the lieutenant there in his headquarters, and took the captain of the German group over to see our general, because this German captain said he had an ultimatum asking for our surrender. So our captain took the German into Bastogne. See, we're surrounded around the outside, probably a mile from downtown. And he took this German into Bastogne, where our general's headquarters was, and gave the ultimatum to our general. And the general looked at it, and it gave us 24 hours, no, 2 hours to surrender. And the general was talking with his staff, and he said, well, what kind of a reply should we give him? Well, the one aide, his aide, said, well, why don't you just give him what you said when you got the ultimatum? He looked at it, and he said, nuts. Well, that's when the aide said, give him that as a reply. So the general wrote to the German commander, nuts from the American commander, and took it back to the German officer, and he read the thing, and he says, nuts, nuts, I don't know what that means. And the lieutenant of the 327th Regiment said, that's the same as go to hell. So the German said, well, a lot of Americans will die because of this. And the four of them took off down the road again under the white flag. And 2 hours later, they started artillery firing again. But I still have the message that the general sent Christmas Eve, thanking us for the valiant effort and so forth. A typical general response to troops, and also thanking us for a Christmas present given to the Americans back home on Christmas Eve. And that was about the worst part. We were getting food after that. We started getting mail again. The open part of the encirclement that Patton opened up, trucks would come in with food and mail and take German prisoners and wounded out back to American hospitals and field hospitals in the area.
How many men were there? It was all Americans that were surrounded, correct? There were no British troops or anything. Is that right? How many Americans approximately were surrounded?
Around 10,000. There was the couple anti-tank battalions that had come back from retreating when the German breakthrough came, and then they stopped at Bastogne and became a part of the defense of the Bastogne area. So there were scattered remnants, but 10,000 101st Airborne Division troops.
How big of an area was it approximately, do you think?
5 miles across, because artillery on our side could fire over to the other side on any invasion. Every morning, the Germans would try to attack from a different point. And had they attacked from three or four at one time, they could have broken through, I think. But the minute they attacked from one side, all the surplus troops on the other side of the encirclement would come over there to help with the defense. And that continued three, 4 days that way. But I remember Christmas Eve, we could hear it was cold and clear, about 10 below, and the no wind, and you could hear the Germans singing Silent Night, Holy Night in German, of course. But we thought the next day is going to be fine. If they're celebrating tonight and singing Christmas carols and maybe got some liquor stashed away somewhere, that everything will be fine tomorrow. But at 7 o'clock the next morning, they attack in our area of the circlement. And well, we knocked out 16 tanks that morning, I remember. But we were sure that everything would be peaceful all through Christmas Day. But I was in an artillery unit, and the 327th Infantry was out in front of us, and they just dropped down in their foxholes and let the tanks come through. And then we started knocking out the tanks, and they were knocking out the infantry that was following behind the tanks. So this went on till about 7 until maybe 8:30, and then the Germans start pulling back again. They realize they were not going to break through.
Till 8:30 in the morning, or at night? 8:30 in the morning?
Yep. Only an hour and a half or so. And their advancing tanks were knocked out, and most of the infantry. And you could tell they'd been drinking, too. They were yelling and everything as they come over the hill. And so I don't know if it was liquor or doped up somehow, but... and the ones we captured, one I talked to was 15 years old. And he said, why are you putting up such a intense battle? He can speak English. He said, you're surrounded. I said, well, you're the one that's captured, not us. So they were using old men, some of them 60, and they were using young kids, 14, 15, 16 years old. So they were scraping the bottom of the barrel by the time they started the Battle of the Bulge.
So it was about 5 miles across. Was it about 5 miles in the other direction as well?
Yeah, it was a circle.
Okay. And you guys knew you were surrounded. Very quickly, you knew that.
Yeah. In fact, they came with the four men and told us we were surrounded. But you could tell they could attack from any side. And all we were trying to do was keep them from using that railroad or that highway hub with all the roads in and out, because then they would have been able to move forward. We were told to hold at all costs. And the 82nd Airborne was north of us at St. Vith, and they were also attacking anybody that was trying to come around Bast Arms. It was a tough battle because everybody was in summer clothes yet and had these leather boots on that were cold as could be. And so the ones I felt sorry for, I came from Minnesota, and I know how to take care of myself in cold weather, even wrapping burlap or anything around your feet and keeping circulation going. But these guys from Florida and California and Texas, they really suffered. And even today, the few that are alive will say, I've never been so cold in my life. I got a call from a guy in Macon, Georgia over Christmas. And he's still, at Christmas time, he says, all I remember is cold at Christmas Day. And I sit as close to the fire today as I can. So they suffered more than anybody because they didn't know how to handle cold weather. We dug some pretty deep holes and put canvas over the holes and then logs over that. And we, four of us, had a hole that was about 10 feet square or so. So by putting the tarp over that, then putting logs, and then another tarp, and dirt that we dug out of the hole over the tarp, we could have a candle on each end of that, and it kept fairly warm. It's amazing what a candle will heat up if it's enclosed in something. So we stayed warm, but there always had to be somebody out on guard duty in a regular foxhole. And usually two to a foxhole. One slept or dozed off, the other one stayed awake. But that was still cold out there. But every 2 hours you could come back to this enclosed dugout we had and warm up.
So you'd rotate. You'd have one or two men outside of the foxhole and then two men in the foxhole?
Two men in the foxhole and two men in the enclosure that was being kept warm. And then every 2 hours they would come out and the other two go back in the hole.
So the foxhole was about how deep?
About 4 feet. You couldn't stand up in it, but you'd crawl in and you could sit or lay. And it was nice and warm in there, probably 60 degrees.
Okay, so now the part where you had the canvas and then the logs on top and the canvas, that was considered to be the foxhole, or?
No,
that was the enclosure, right?
That was the place where we used to warm up, and the foxhole was just big enough for two men to get down in.
And to watch for enemy fire.
Yeah, one would try to sleep a little bit if they could, and the other would watch, and then take turns, probably half an hour at a time. And at the end of 2 hours, you'd go back to the large enclosed area, and two other ones would come out.
So the large enclosed area was 60 degrees about?
I can't tell you exactly, but it was warm enough so you didn't have to have gloves on or anything. And the two candles threw off a lot of heat.
And so did you, during that five-day period, approximately, it was from like the 20th, Patton broke through on the 27th, did you say?
26th.
And you got there on the 22nd?
No, we left Mormelon on the 18th.
On the 18th. So between the 18th and the 26th, did you have the same enclosure, or were you always moving within that circle?
No. I was in an artillery unit, and we stayed in one place, had our gun there. There's four guns to a battery. So there were three other guns besides ours. But all we had to do was make certain that if tanks came, we could fire on them. And the infantry pretty well stayed in the same place, too. Had a certain segment of that encirclement that was the responsibility of so many men. And they would dig their foxholes and stay there. The men would be moved only if there was an attempted breakthrough somewhere, and they may send extra men over there, but they would only be there until the breakthrough was prevented from happening, or the Germans would pull back on their own, then the men would go back to their permanent position that they had.
The infantrymen would?
The infantrymen,
yeah. Okay. What kind of guns did the infantrymen have?
The M1.
M1?
And there were some, the officers, I think, carried the 30 caliber carbine, and that's what we had, too. But infantry had the Turan, which was a very good rifle.
And what was a 30 caliber carbine? Tell me more about that, please.
Well, 50 caliber is about a half an inch.
Okay.
30 caliber is 3/10 of an inch.
Okay.
In diameter for the shell. And it has less powder. But most of the fighter planes all had 50 calibers in them, and the Jeeps had 50 calibers mounted. You couldn't carry a 50 caliber very easily. It was a fairly large gun, and there was a lot of kick to it. But the 30 caliber carbine was fairly small, and it had a folding stock that you, instead of having the long stock that you put up to your shoulder on the jump, it was folded, and then you had it laying across your chest. And then as soon as you got on the ground, you opened it up. It was a metal-type framework that made up the stock for the rifle. It wasn't a very accurate rifle. Anything over 75 yards, you were lucky if you could hit something.
Okay.
The infantry rifle, fairly good up to a half a mile.
So the M1 was pretty good up to a half a mile?
Yeah.
But for the 30 carbine, it would be about 75 yards.
75 to 100, that's about it. Length of a football field.
Okay. Now, but as the artillery unit, what were you carrying for the artillery unit? What were you using?
What was I using?
Yeah.
We all had carbines.
Okay.
And I would aim the guns, so So I had a naming circle, too.
Okay.
Which, and all that is a result of my surveying during the summer with Wilton County Highway, the first year out of high school. The Army thought I had some experience in surveying, and when you lay the guns, you need some surveying experience, so the guns are all pointing in the same direction. So when you fire, all rounds land in about the same area. So that little bit of surveying that summer probably saved my life, because rather than going into the infantry, they put me in the artillery.
And how many rounds would come out of one of these guns? How fast?
Well, you could fire probably 5 rounds in a minute.
In a minute?
You had to take the old empty cartridge out and put a new one in. And normally there were 4 powder bags in the shell. And depending on the range that you were going to fire, you either took out 2 powder bags or you determined you needed 3 powder bags. So once you determined the distance to the target and how much powder you needed, there was always someone on the gun crew that's taking the shell out of the cartridge and taking out the number of powder bags that was determined had to be in there to send the projectile as far as it was needed to be sent.
And so the projectile could go how far?
We had what was a 75 millimeter.
Okay.
That's about a 3-inch diameter shell. And that had a range of around 9,000 yards, which 1,700 yards is a mile. So to be probably around 5 miles that this gun would shoot.
And so as an artilleryman, you would have a group of you that would be behind a projectile, is that correct?
Yeah, it was called a gun crew.
A gun crew.
It was the guy that was out in the aiming, and a fellow that would handle the shells. Someone would handle what they call the trail, so you could move the gun, the back end of the gun, one way or the other. The gun sits in a small pit, and the back end of the gun has got an edge on it that digs into this pit so that there's no recoil. The gun may jump up in front and come back down in the same location. So in order to ensure accuracy, you had to keep this gun as stationary as possible. So the trail or the back end of the gun was down in the soil, probably a foot or a foot and a half, to prevent it from rolling backwards or from jumping out of position.
Okay, so they could go, if it's 9,000 yards, they could go about 5 miles. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And so your primary targets were for armored tanks.
Well, no, infantry too.
Infantry also?
Yeah, if you saw some activity. And we had one man that was a forward observer with the infantry. He'd go up there and then by radio or telephone would call back to the gun crew. First he would fire a shell that had smoke in it. So you'd fire one shell and then the forward observer would look and see where that shell landed in relation to the target. The target may be way over here.
Okay.
So when he sees that smoke shell, he says, calls back to the gun crew, 200 yards right, 100 over. So over here, he's expecting to bring the next shell down 100 yards and 400 or 300 yards over this way. So they fire one more shell. And if it lands somewhere near the target that the forward observer has observed, he may say fire for effect, and then you'll fire, if he says 4 rounds for effect or 6 rounds for effect, then you fire as fast as you can because he's on the target, and you don't want the target to move away. But it very seldom takes more than 5 or 6 rounds to complete what they call a mission, a firing mission, because you've either knocked out the target or the target has moved away so quickly you have to come up with a new set of aimings to register on the next target.
Okay, so the forward man, the infantry man, would go and have 1 or 2 shells shot that was just smoke, is what you're saying.
The infantry man has an artillery man up there. He thinks he knows where the target is. It may be a building somewhere where there's 5, 6 men in there.
Okay.
And he tells them. Then the artillery man does the adjusting.
Okay.
Fires the first round and fires as close as he thinks he can get to the target. Even though he's just firing a smoke shell won't do much other than provide a lot of smoke. There's no shrapnel. And he tries to figure out exactly where he thinks this target is, whether it's 800 yards ahead and an azimuth of maybe 20 degrees. So he tries his best to get as close to that target as he can with that first shell he asked for, that smoke. Once he gets that smoke shell, then he can adjust. And what he'll actually do is probably adjust too far to the right. If this was 200 yards to the left, he will say right 400 yards. He wants to be 200 yards on the other side. Then he knows that if he cuts it in half, he's right on the target. So he will do that, another smoke shell to the right, and then fire high explosive for on target.
Okay, so an infantryman goes up front to kind of scope it out, and then the artilleryman goes and does the smoke shell, the first one and the second one, correct?
Yeah.
And that's so that you guys preserve artillery, so you're not wasting artillery, is that why? And
well,
to help you aim better, the two combined reasons?
Well, before you fire on the target with 5, 6, 7 rounds, you want to be pretty certain you're right in the area where the shells are going to land on target.
Okay.
And once they start landing on target, the infantryman determines from what he saw or how many rounds it would take to knock it off. If it was a tank that went behind a building, they may fire 6, 7, 8 rounds. And if they can see the tankman running out of there, they may fire some more to try to knock the tankman out, too.
Okay. So the primary purpose then for the smoke rounds that were shot is to so that you're not wasting artillery? Is that both for an aiming perspective and so you're not wasting artillery?
Well, I guess the primary reason is to determine where you're firing in relation to where the target is.
Okay.
You don't want to start firing wildly until you know you're somewhere in the vicinity of the target, and then you start firing this high explosive. There's various types of there's smoke shells, there's HE, they call it, high explosives. There's AP, armor piercing. You fire an armor piercing shell at a tank so that it would penetrate the metal in the tank and attempt to get the tankers inside or set the tank on fire or whatever. So there is different type of artillery shells along with the smoke shell we were talking about.
Okay.
So the artilleryman determines whether he should use armor piercing or whether he should use high explosive. There's also another type of shell called, it will explode at a different depth or height from the ground. It may explode 60 feet off the ground, or 30 feet, whatever you have it set for, or 100 feet off the ground. And you want to use that when there's infantry. Say the field is full of infantry, and this shell will explode 60 feet off the ground, and the shrapnel will spread and cover a large area, and actually for the purpose of getting infantry.
Okay.
Well, once they determine how many bags of powder they needed to reach that distance, then this guy would start taking this. One guy would start taking all the shells apart. You just put the shell out of the cartridge, and he would make sure there's only 3 bags in each shell that they're going to use.
Okay.
And there were 2 men that used. There was about a 7-man crew.
Okay.
One was an aimer, one was 2 were trail men, probably 2 working on bringing ammunition to the gun, and another one checking the bags. Everybody had a different job, and they were interchangeable. The fellow that counted the bags and the shell might be on the trail the next firing mission.
So the trail men are the men that go forward, the artillery man and the infantry man.
They're the ones that move the back end of the gun.
That move the back end of the gun.
Yeah.
Okay. So the infantry man that goes forward and the artillery man that goes forward to do the smoke shells, they have in many ways one of the most dangerous jobs, right? Because they're putting themselves at risk.
Yeah. The Germans would love to get the observers because they're the ones that are bringing the artillery down on them, and if they can knock them out, then the firing would probably cease. And another means of observing had the L-5 Cub plane that would fly back and forth in the front, and they would observe where the smoke shell was, and they could see the target probably from up above. And then they would do the pilot would have an artilleryman riding with him. One time a Cub plane ran into one of our shells we were firing at the enemy. Just see, they're in front of us, and they're going back and forth to observe the target that's being fired on. So they get down there so far, and they turn around and come back again. And this particular time, and it doesn't happen very often, but it was a coincidence, that a shell we fired, he happened to be in the right place with the plane at the time the shell went past and hit the plane instead of being sent on, and blew both the observer and the pilot to pieces along with the plane.
That must have been hard to witness.
Well, yes. You witness a lot of things that are difficult to. Have you ever seen Saving Private Ryan?
Mm-hmm.
You see the first 25 minutes? That was pretty graphic. And that was the outfit I was in. I'm in 1st Airborne Division. And the purpose of Saving Private Ryan, his brother had been killed in the Pacific somewhere. He was the only other member of his family, so they were going to bring him home. He wouldn't do any more fighting, or there wouldn't be any descendant from his family. The objective of this group was to find Private Ryan and send him home. Those kids over there grow up knowing all about World War II
mm-hmm.
that our kids
don't know anything
never
about.
Know about, or probably don't even care. But
yep.
Over there, they say we would be speaking German if it wasn't for you guys. And they're really, really thank us every year for
mm-hmm.
what we did over there.
Eh?
We have an American cemetery in Dragon on. There's about 800 of our guys there. It's a small cemetery, but beautifully kept up. And let's see what other town is around there. If you hadn't asked me, I could tell you all of them.
Is it, so it's in the northeast corner of France?
No, it's down there along the Riviera. And Saint-Tropez, and between there and Nice.
Okay, so on the coast.
Yeah, but we jumped 13 miles, 15 miles in, so that we could block the roads that the Germans would use in trying to repulse the invading force coming from the sea, like landing craft.
Now, which branch of the military? Were you in the Army then as a paratrooper?
It was U.S. Army Paratroops, it was called.
Okay.
And we, I guess, you just call us infantry, artillery. We just had a different means of coming in by parachute rather than by truck or boat. And once we jumped, that was the end. I mean, we probably never got to jump again, although some in the 101st, they've got as many as three jumps. They started out in Africa. The 82nd Airborne jumped in Sicily, and then they jumped again in Holland, jumped in Normandy, and very few have four jumps, but a larger number have three jumps. Most paratroopers have one or two at the most.
So you had just the one jump into France?
Yep.
Okay. How many jumps did you have before you came over to Europe?
Well, 12.
12 practice jumps?
Yes. Some at night, some during the day.
And so you came in, right? Oh, Lemieux, right here.
Yep.
Okay, by Saint-Raphaël.
And Draguignan should be there too somewhere.
Yep, got it, right up here, Draguignan. Okay, so you were jumping right into there, and how big was Lemieux?
Oh, I suppose 5,000.
And how long did you stay there before you moved up north?
Well, from there we moved into the Maritime Alps, and we ended up at Col de Bras, which was the high point in the Alps. We got as far as the Maginot Line. The French built that between World War I and World War II. And we stayed up in Col de Bras for, it was kind of a stalemate there for maybe 2 weeks. And then we moved down to the coast again and came back to Nice for our trip to Mormelon, the first part of November. Sospel is the last town we liberated, and that was the last place in France, I guess, that was liberated. That's down near the coast, near Mentone, close to Italy.
Okay.
And they still welcome us with open arms every time we come over there. We've made about 7-8 trips back there. And my wife's gone along a couple of times. And they do everything they can to make our welcome pleasant and enjoyable. So we have a lot of friends over there. The only people that don't like us, I think, are those from Paris. They they won't even admit they speak English. If all these French down in the southern part, they do anything they possibly can to make our trip enjoyable. Put us up, you know, so we don't have hotel expense, and have banquets, and dances. And I come home, I always have to join AA for a year or so. I don't know what water is over there.
So that must be awfully wonderful to have that meaningful connection.
Yeah. And it's the same way in Belgium. They adopt some of our cemeteries, and different people take care of putting flowers on Memorial Day or 4th of July. And they actually take pictures, you know, of the grave site, send them to us. They're on our email. Once a week we have an email where everybody sees what's happening to everybody else. If there's a death in the family, or if there's a marriage or something, it's on that email that everybody gets to read.
And how many men were in your...
2,500.
2,500?
Called a combat team, and there were a number of those. The Japanese Americans had a combat team too. We have a senator in Washington that was in that 442nd, Anu or something like that, Nu. He was from Hawaii.
So the 442nd was the Japanese American.
These guys volunteered. They came out of encampments that they were sent to. They'd taken off the west coast and sent inland because the government was afraid they were furnishing information to the Japanese government,
mm-hmm.
Which was totally untrue. But can you imagine having your family shipped inland to a similar to a concentration camp, and all your worldly goods taken from you out on the west coast where you've built up a business? And then have your sons volunteer to join the military to fight against the armies that are fighting you. These people have more awards, decorations, and more injured, more killed than any other unit in the military. So they proved they're loyal. That was the whole thing. They thought they had to do the extra mile to prove that they were loyal Americans. I guess the government has finally compensated them by providing them with $30,000 per member for all those they moved in from the coast, but the insult is already over with, and money would not replace what they must have suffered in
mm-hmm.
pain and questionable loyalty that we placed upon them.
The trauma that goes with that.
Pardon?
And the trauma that goes
yes.
with that.
No, we, a little funny incident, after being in southern France, things stabilized, we got some 3-day passes, and there was a rest camp down near Nice. We went to it, and German prisoners were running the thing, cooking the meals and keeping the camp clean and all that. And they were good soldiers. And they would march in step from their barracks to the mess hall where they were going to cook meals for us during the day. Where the Americans, you know, they'd shuffle along out of step and talking, and they marched as though they were still under German command. The sergeant would be a German, and he'd march them in perfect formation. But anyway, this one morning, there was a Japanese American from 442nd at the same camp on leave. And we're going through the line for breakfast, and I could see this German was puzzled with this Japanese fellow right ahead of me. And he could understand English, too. I said, oh, hasn't Hitler told you? Japan has surrendered, and they're fighting with us now. And he was puzzled as could be. He could see the guy was Japanese, all right, but he just couldn't understand how that could happen, and nobody had ever told him about it. And we never did tell him either that they were American citizens.
Now, when would this be? What month would this have been in?
Well, probably October of 44.
October of 44? Okay.
They had relieved us in Italy, but then we brought a company of Japanese Americans by glider into France as an anti-tank group. So they'd never ridden in a glider. They were loaded on gliders and brought to France and landed. And these gliders land about 90 miles an hour, and they have no wheels. So you come down on bare ground, and sometimes they just tumble. Other times, enough friction that they keep the thing upright. I suppose the pilot navigates the tail so it holds it down, but many times they'll flip over when they hit the ground. So here's these Japanese Americans that had never been in a glider coming to France by glider. That must have been quite an experience.
How many men would be on a glider about?
Well, if they don't carry anything else, you can get 13. If you have a jeep in there, there may only be 4 or 5 guys. Or if you have a gun, it could probably be 7 guys. Just depends. There's a certain load that you could carry, and the glider people knew when they've reached the maximum load capacity. The outside of the glider is just kind of a waxed canvas, and then the rest is framework inside, just electrical tubing. And I had one glider ride, and that's all I ever wanted. But that flapping of the canvas outside is noise and very disturbing. You wonder when it's going to fly off. And there's two pilots, co-pilot and a pilot, that come in. And if you don't have that jeep securely tightened, there were cases where that would break loose and then it would hit the two pilots and crush them against the front of the glider. So that was terrible. And the glider men didn't get extra pay to begin with. We got an extra $50 a month as hazardous duty pay.
For paratroopers only?
Yeah.
Okay.
Later on they changed that, but I think it was after the war. The glider men never got any extra pay. And I think the gliders were much more dangerous than the parachute thing, because they could get shot down pretty easily. The planes were not that fast, and maximum speed for a C-47 was probably around 140 miles an hour. And we jumped, they slowed down to 90 miles an hour so that the opening shock wouldn't be so severe. And the parachute blossoms and the prop blast hits it. But if you had a ring on or watch, it would rip it right off your hand. I mean, it'd fly off without any trouble, just from being snapped when the chute opens.
So where were the... Okay, so when you were... Tell me, when you first got into France, into Le Mieux, when was the first time that you guys actually had combat? How long was it, and where was it when you first had combat?
About the 10 minutes after getting out of the plane.
Right there you had combat. Okay, so you were surrounded by Germans at the time?
Well, we weren't surrounded, but they were everywhere. And they were confused, too, because we were scattered all over. See, there were about 5,000 that jumped. And there was a light cloud mist. We thought we were out over the water when we jumped. And finally someone yelled, "It's a cloud." You could hear for a mile up there just a normal tone of voice.
Really?
There's no reflection or anything. It's just, you can yell to someone and he can hear you 2 miles away. But someone yelled, "It's a cloud," so then came down through that. And but the pilots got scattered too, the ones flying the planes. So the intent is to try to all come down close together. But once the pilots have no navigation, then they get scattered. They're flying in V form. You'll see it in there. There's 45 planes. They start out one, then two, then three, then four, until you get up to nine across. And it's a big V. That's mm-hmm. called a serial. And then you have these serials about 100 yards apart. And before you fly to jump, you have what is called a pathfinders. They go in about half an hour before you do and set up radio equipment so that the plane can follow a beam in. And the pilot beams in on this radio that the pathfinders have set up and try to come in right on target. But if the first plane with the plane with the pathfinders doesn't hit the target, then about all they can do is set up their radio, but they're going to bring the planes in on someplace other than target too. He tried to hit a target that was flat, and the Germans love to put up telephone poles in the middle of a flat area to break up the gliders coming in, knock the wings off, and ruin them. And they want to soak a field with gasoline where the paratroopers are going to land, so that the minute the jump starts taking place, they can light that field on fire, and you come down into the fire. So we got scattered quite widely, and it was good in a way because the Germans thought there were a lot more than actually were. Because every place they went, there was somebody firing at them. And then there were 600 dummies dropped near Toulon.
Okay.
That did nothing, but when they hit, it starts setting off things like firecrackers. So the Germans sent a bunch of people over there to try to capture them. And they got there and there was nothing but big dummies that had parachutes hooked on them and they were dumped out of the plane. One plane load did land the guys in the ocean, Mediterranean, and we never heard from them again.
So they all drowned, or?
Well, I suppose, because you carry about 100 pounds of extra equipment with you.
Okay.
You jump. And that would take you right down to the bottom if you couldn't get off. And if they dropped them, say, 10 miles out at sea, there'd be no way they could swim in either. Going into Sicily, the 82nd Airborne flew over some American ships. Somebody started firing at them. And the American ships knocked down 27 plane loads of American paratroopers with about 10 in each plane. So there were 270 went into the ocean there. There's all kinds of mistakes that happen that people never hear about or read about. It just happens. Our Air Corps bombed one time. There was supposed to be a smoke line set up so that the planes would bomb ahead of that. And what happened, the wind changed and blew it the other way. And our American plane bombed our own troops and killed hundreds of them. And you never, that's just called friendly fire, and you never hear about it again.
Where was this when this happened?
Pardon?
Where was this?
In France.
Down by Lemieux, or?
No, no, I couldn't even tell you the location. I just read about it. There was a terrible incident in England, too, and they've just made it public recently, but the Americans were practicing before the invasion of Normandy, and they were off the coast of England with landing craft, and some German, like our PT boats, got in amongst them, and 800 and some got killed by Germans. This was just a practice run to come into the shore at England so that the troops could experience landing on shore. The Christmas Eve of 1944, a ship left England going to France with 800 American soldiers, and a German submarine sunk it. And the boat and all 800 went down. And these things just happen, I guess. Nobody's really at fault. They take a chance. And how many times would you expect a German submarine to be at right location mm-hmm. when a ship is going that 25 miles or whatever it is from England to France. They sunk it, everybody on the ship went down. And it's bad because here's not only loss of life, but 800 trained soldiers ready to go into battle, and they're gone in an instant and never did see the battle that they were trained to fight in.
Saving Private Ryan, how did you feel that that was portrayed the first 25 minutes? How true was that to form?
Well, see, I think it was realistic on the Normandy invasion because if I remember correctly, there were around 10,000 killed on that invasion. So it had to be pretty good. The only thing about Saving Ryan, Private Ryan, he never came in. If he was with the 101st Airborne, he never came in by ship. He jumped back from the coast and provided the same protection that the paratroops are intended to provide, either prevent troops coming down to oppose the invasion or knocking out guns in the rear that would be firing on invading forces. And I don't know if you saw Band of Brothers. That was about a six-hour thing. Mm-hmm. And that was the 101st Airborne that I was in. And in that case, it was Easy Company. The whole story was about Easy Company and Major Winters, who died just less than a year ago, I guess. His objective was to knock out an artillery battery that was about 8 miles back from the coast that was firing on the troops coming in by landing craft. And that's realistic because they jumped back there, but Saving Private Ryan implied that he came in on the coast, and that was not true. But otherwise, it was fairly realistic. Thing I didn't believe was that about 10 or 15 men were all walking together, talking, and I think the purpose of that was to try to convey what the story was going to be about, what the purpose of the movie was, to find Private Ryan, where normally you spread out 100 yards or so between men, 50 yards, so that one shell doesn't come in and knock out 10, 12 men. Probably get one or two, but the rest would be all right. So that, otherwise, it was fairly realistic.
When you were in Belgium at the Battle of Bastogne, is that how you say it?
They, over there, they say Bastogne.
Bastogne?
Here, the Bastogne.
You said that the medical personnel were taken by the Germans. What happened to them the first time around, the first set of medical personnel?
Well, they were captured and put in a prison camp, German prison camp somewhere, I suppose. We never saw them again. But that was only medical people from our outfit. In every division and every unit has first aid men, and a division will have a doctor. We had a major that was a surgeon, and he was head of the 517th medical team. But this captured group, they were part of the 101st Airborne Division. So that was in headquarters battery of the division. Our major was in the headquarters battery of the 3 battalions of infantry. It's pretty well organized, the military. You got three squads that make up a platoon. You have three platoons that make up a company. Three companies make up a battalion. Three battalions will make up a regiment. Three regiments will make up a division with some added parts, motor pool and all that, but it's usually three of everything. And a squad probably will have 15 men, and three times that for a platoon, around 40, 45 men. Company, maybe 200 men. So it's pretty consistent on how it's organized. And then you have attachments, medical and motor pools, and other extra men for certain specific duties.
Tell me about the engineers. What do the engineers do?
Repair bridges, blow up power plants, anything to do with construction. We had the road up to Kolderbrau blown out by the Germans, because that road going up there is just back and forth till you get to the top. Going around one curve, they blew out part of that bridge. Well, the engineers had to come in and rebuild that part of the road. Up until that time, there was enough room to mules to carry supplies up. But once the engineers got the road rebuilt, we could take jeeps with trailers and things to go up. And we had six killed at the Nice. We have a plaque in the front of the Nice airport that have the six men listed that were killed removing mines at the airport. The Germans had the airport totally mined, and the Americans took all the mines out, but this truckload of mines blew up and killed six guys. The French allowed us to put a plaque at the entrance to the airport lobby with the names of these men that were killed removing mines.
And they were part of the 101st?
No, that's 517.
517, okay.
The 517th remained all the way through the war, but I was put in the 101st just before the Battle of the Bulge. I was in the 463rd Field Artillery. I started out in the 460th. Well, when the 17th Airborne didn't get over here to France from England, the 463rd Colonel Cooper asked the 101st Division commander, the 17th is not here yet, could we go into Bastogne with the 101st? And we went in with the 101st, and then toward the end of the war, they wanted to put us back in the 17th, and General Taylor said, no, they have become a part of the 101st, and the 101st would not like it if you remove the 463rd and put them back in the 17th Airborne, and the 463rd would rather stay in the 101st rather than go back. So they transferred the whole outfit to the 101st, and we remained with them until they broke the 101st up after being down in Berchtesgaden and Bavaria.
So all 2,500 all 2,500 of your core team, parachute core team, were part of the 101st?
No.
Only just the part?
The 2,500 was the 517th. The 460th was part of the 517th. There were three battalion infantry, the 460th battalion of artillery, and the engineers, the 596th. But while I was in the 460th, part of the 517th, I accidentally shot one of our men one night on patrol, or not on patrol, but on outpost. He come in, didn't know the password. But once you shoot somebody in an outfit, the Army reassigns you. They court-martial you, first of all, so you can't be tried in civilian court again. And then give you a carton of cigarettes and transfer you out in case this fellow that got killed has a good friend that might want to revenge his death. You're no longer part of that outfit. So I was transferred from the 460th to the 463rd, which was another battalion of artillery. So when we got up to Mormelon, I was the only one out of the 517th that was not with the 517th anymore. And the 460th didn't have a division to belong to. The 17th was coming over but had not arrived. So the 463rd Artillery Battalion, Commander Cooper, asked General McAuliffe if he could have his battalion moved into the 101st Airborne Division. And I knew none of these guys. I came in out of that. They had fought in Africa, Sicily, and Italy. And so I was totally new with them. And that's how I got in the 101st. The 517th men never did get into. Later on, toward the end of the war, they were in Sisson, France, S-I-O-I-S-S, I guess, just outside of Paris away. They were transferred into the 13th Airborne, who had never seen combat at all. The war had ended before they got in combat. So the 517th and the 13th Airborne did not get along very well. Many of the men that had paperwork in route for awards that they would be given for activity that they performed, the 13th Airborne Command reduced those awards or took a lot of them away. Nobody knows why, but 517th was not very close with the men of the 13th Airborne, because 13th was trying to use the 517th as a part of the record of their wartime experience. And the 517th didn't become a part of the 13th Airborne until after the war was over. So the 13th really had no claim to combat duty. other than through I-17.
So when you first went to, you said it was 101st Airborne, you didn't know any of the guys, correct?
When I was transferred in there.
Okay. So how did that feel? I would think that would be very unsettling.
Yes, because I'm a complete stranger to them, and they have their own little clique that they've grown up with from Africa through Sicily, Italy. But one way I became adopted, I think, is because on outpost duty, you're on 2 hours and off four. Well, say your duty starts at 10 at night. I'd go out there at probably 9:45, 15 minutes before I was supposed to, and this guy would be relieved. Then I may, instead of coming in at 12 o'clock, I may come in at 12:20. So the fellow I'm supposed to send out on outpost has already had 20 minutes of his two-hour period used. And I think that did more to get me accepted with the group than anything else, that you take more than your share of the time spent on outpost.
So what month was it when you went to the 101st?
Well, it would be December 15th.
December 15th, so right before you were in Estonia.
Right into the Bulge.
Okay.
See, we didn't go into the Bulge until the 18th, I think. We had come back from southern France, and the 101st and the 82nd had come from Holland, and the Germans attacked, and Eisenhower thought it's just a small, isolated attack. Well, it took 2-3 days for them to realize this is a major attack that Germans are pulling. They have a million men advancing. So then the orders came from Eisenhower to have the two divisions moving within 12 hours. This was, he notified them in the morning. By 8 that evening, we were headed for Bastogne, and 82nd Airborne was headed for St. Vith, and we were driving all night long with headlights on so that we could make as much distance as we could, because whoever got to Bastogne first would have control of all those roads leading in and out. So normally you drive with a little slip on the front of the lights, the rest is all darkened out. But we got there just hours before the Germans got to Bastogne. And it was a good thing, because that held them up from branching out, getting through Bastogne, and then the roads going in all directions, seven roads. They would have continued with their tanks on those roads.
How long did it take before you felt like you were accepted by the guys in the 101st Airborne?
Probably 2 weeks.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about when you accidentally shot the other man?
Well, it was during the night, and I had just come out of being sleepy. I mean, I was off. I was ready to take on. See, we were in a U-shape, and it's in the book. We were in one position, and then across this valley was another group, an outpost. And I just didn't get any password, and I yelled, at least in, I don't know if I was still asleep in a dream, but I yelled out our password and got no response. So I just fired, and then he started yelling, "Medic." And if you're hit or wounded, you yell, "Medic, medic," and there's always a first aid man around to give you morphine or bandage up a wound or whatever. And I'd heard later that morning that he died, so that's when the the action was taken, a court martial, found guilty, and fined a dollar, and given a carton of cigarettes, and then shipped to a replacement depot, is where the replacements come. I sat in there, and some guy from the 463rd came and picked me up. Didn't say anything to me all the way back to where the 463rd was. I could feel the unfriendliness right then. But in 2-3 weeks, things were pretty good. But I never got as close to those guys as I did to the 517. All my reunions over the last 50 years was reunions with the 517th. Because I spent 15 months with them training and going to jump school and going overseas. And so that was my outfit, even though I was in the 463rd. And we still correspond today. We have a mini reunion coming up in middle of January. We have a national reunion coming up in Kansas City in July, and a mini reunion at Palm Springs in April. And some of them come in wheelchairs, some come in walkers, some don't come at all because they're nursing homes, and some have died. Just the last week, a couple guys died. So it isn't going to be long, and we're all gone. And many of the outfits have broken up. They say, I know the 101st is broken up now. They said it's not served no purpose to hold reunions anymore because there's nobody that can come. Those that can are not interested because none of their friends show up. Years ago when we'd have 500-600 there, it was broken up to like the 460th had four batteries. Each battery had 100 men in it. So battery C that I was in, maybe 35 guys would show up from that. And we would have our own little reunion within the reunion. And the battalions of infantry, they'd have their own. The engineers would have their own. Now, out of the 2,500, you're lucky if you get 7 or 8 that show up out of the 2,500. And, of course, of those 7, you, if you're lucky, you know one of them. The other 7, they were in other battalions, and you never did get to know them. So there really isn't much purpose in going to reunions anymore. The second generation and third generation, they want to continue it. The sons and daughters and the grandsons continue holding these reunions, and they show up. But I see no purpose in that. If their fathers and grandfathers aren't going to be there, they could just as well meet with family somewhere rather than meet with a bunch of strangers that they don't know.
How many men out of the 2,500 are still alive?
Nobody seems to know, but I imagine we have a booklet that goes out. It serves 300, but that serves relatives and other people that have requested it's called the Thunderbolt. But I imagine there's probably 75 of the 2,500 that's still alive.
How many of them got killed in action?
So 247 men were killed and 1,576 were wounded.
An 80% casualty rate.
And out of the 10,000 that were at the Battle of Estonia, how many of those made it out alive?
Are still alive?
No, after the battle. How many got killed during the battle?
Well, it's in books. I really don't know. But I imagine at least 2,000.
And how often on your team, like your team of 7 men that were doing artillery, how often did you lose men on your team?
There were 2 killed right on the jump. out of our battery. That was out of the 100 men. And five out of the 100 all got killed altogether. But two got killed within 20 minutes of, after the jump. They were going to rush a machine gun nest. And they both carried Thompson 45 submachine guns. And when they rushed the German machine gun, both of their guns jammed. So they couldn't fire anything. The Germans cut both of them down. But the others were killed over a period of time. One of them was, out of the five, was the one I killed, and then two others. One was a forward observer one time. So we had five out of our battery, and the information's in the book on out of the whole 460th, which was a battalion. There weren't too many because the artillery's back a ways, and if you're somewhere near a shell that lands you. When I was in Bastogne, a German 88 shell came in and landed from here to that chair from me, but it was a dud. And it plowed into the ground and it didn't explode. That would have killed me. The slave laborers that Germans hired a lot of times would sabotage some of this equipment. Instead of putting powder in, they might put in something that looked like powder, sand or sugar or something. And there was many pieces of equipment that failed because the slave labor the Germans had working for them sabotaged the stuff they were supposed to be making. Another time I almost got killed, we were at Bastogne. We were surrounded. It was the 26th of December, clear day, and the fighter planes were out. And the fighter plane comes over our position, and I'm waving, thinking that he's going to acknowledge by tipping his wings. They'll do that when they want to acknowledge they know who you are or something, just up and down with their wings. Well, I'm waving to him, and all at once I see these tracers coming out of his wings, 50 caliber shells. And they've got three, I think, along each wing, 50 calibers. Well, I'm standing here, and they're going on each side of me. I'm in the dead spot where there's no 50 caliber gun. And had he been over a few feet one way or the other, I would have gotten one of those 50 calibers in. So,
wow.
Being in the right place at the right time.
The airplanes that would fly low, you said, over like at the Battle of Bastogne, that were doing surveillance. What did you call those airplanes?
No, the L-5 Cubs.
The Cubs. How low do they fly?
Well, it just depends how well they could see, but they were always 300 to 400 or 500 feet above the ground.
Okay.
Enough so they could, if the target was over further, they probably fly a little higher, but they wanted to stay between the target and the artillery that's firing on the target, because the closer they get to the target area, the more they get ground fire at, firing up at them too, the rifle and maybe even anti-aircraft. But they were a pretty small target, but they were so slow that they were an easy target with somebody with a rifle would fire at them. 500 feet off the ground isn't too high. Yeah, 1,000 feet sometimes. There was no set limit. It's just it was determined by how well they could see the target.
Did you guys know that Patton was coming on the 26th? Did you know that he's bringing men up to help out?
Well, not the average soldier. I suppose the officers, the general, and by radio was probably told Patton is heading up from the south. He was over in Alsace-Lorraine. He turned the 3rd Army around, and he sent the 4th Armored Division up toward Bastogne, and he was I think, 100 and some miles away. But I got a picture in the book, too, of men walking across the hills toward Bastogne. And he lost a lot of men. I think something like 1,000 men walking toward Bastogne. And this 4th Armored had a bunch of tanks.
How, I'm sure, like what you said, that friendly fire is very common.
How what?
As you mentioned, I'm sure that friendly fire is very common, where people get accidentally
yep.
shot by their own men. How have you come to terms with this? Have you ever made peace with this?
Well, I guess it was difficult to start with. As time went on, I saw that accidents do happen, like the 27 plane load shot down and the bombing of our own troops. And even in recent wars, there's been friendly fire. In Desert Storm, one of the football players that played National League got killed by friendly fire. So I guess I finally accepted it as one of the terrible things that happened, that you accept but never get over, and know that it will happen again in the future. Now they have the manned drones that nobody in them. So if they get shot down, it's a loss of equipment, but not loss of life.
Tell me a little bit about Dusseldorf, if you could. Thanks for sharing that with me, by the way. When you got to Dusseldorf, you said that you guys took over and stayed in some German homes. Were you staying in, the civilians were in the homes and you were sharing the homes with them? Or where were the civilians?
We gave them 10 minutes to get out.
Okay.
And I think most of the fellows were considerate of what was in there. I know the four of us that had this big hole that we kept heated with candles, we roomed together in a place in Bad Reichenhall. I have a picture of in the book, and we had the upstairs. The downstairs was a cafe, and that cafe became a mess hall for a lot of the other troops. We lived upstairs, had two big beds, had a balcony all the way around the chalet, and a German boy worked for us. He was 12 years old, spoke perfect English. We came into the area on about the middle of May or so. The war ended on the 7th of May. Then we continued south. We came in there, and he come running over, and he said, "Where are you fellows coming from?" We told him, and then he wanted to work for us. And we said, "What would you do?" He said, "I'll keep your boots polished, and I'll keep a fire hot in the hot water tank. The hot water tank's over there. If you're going to take a shower or a bath, you build a fire underneath it, put wood in there, and it heats the water up, and then you use it." Well, he said he'd do that, and it wasn't long, and we'd send him. His mother lived in a house near there, and he lived with her. His father had been killed in Italy. He was a major. And so we gave him bread and other things to take home, which that was more, you couldn't be any more helpful than to give him food. The Germans were starving. And we gave him food, and at the end of the month, we'd give him what change we had left. Well, I heard afterwards, I corresponded with him for many years, and he came over here in 1989 to visit me. And we shipped over food after the war and care packages of food that we collected ourselves. And I'd just been married, so it was difficult to, didn't have that much money myself, but he always remembered that, and then he came over to visit me. And he married and had a number of children, and then he divorced and he remarried again. But we finally quit corresponding in about, I suppose, 1990 or something like that. He was a good friend. I mean, after we left there, he went to work for the Air Corps, who took over that area. Kind of lost track of what happened to him until later on when he finally wrote to me and I caught up with what he'd been doing. He was very good in English, and he knew how to take care of himself even 12 years old. He worked for different outfits and had enough money to go to school, and I don't know if he ever went to college. And then from there we went on to Berlin on occupation duty and lived in an SS barracks there. The only thing left in Berlin that resembles the war is a church. That's, they didn't bother repairing that. They left it just as it was at the end of the war. It's still sits as a symbol in the center of Berlin. But here again, the little kids, we had a mess hall, and the GIs would take a little extra food, and the mothers and their kids would stand off to the side. This compound was a SS barracks and training center before the war ended. And the mothers would stand on the outside of the area with their little kids, and each little kid had a pail. And to start with, when we were through, we would leave the mess hall, go back to our barracks, and the kids would come running then to the garbage cans, where everybody threw their food and coughing. And these little kids would reach in there and grab bread and squeeze the coffee out of it and put it in their pails. And anything that looked edible, they would take and take back to their mothers. Well, then it got to the point where we didn't blame these little kids anymore for what happened. We would bring out oranges or an apple or bread with meat on it for a sandwich and give it to the kids before throwing it away. I mean, just actually put it in their pail, because they'd come running out as soon as we came out of the mess hall. So everybody sort of adopted one or two of these little kids and provided them with food, because you couldn't blame them for what had happened. At first, everybody was pretty angry about let them suffer and let them starve if you want to, but they soon got over that.
When they saw how destitute they were?
Yeah. And I suppose most of these mothers had lost their husbands in the war.
What was Berlin like, the town of Berlin?
It was just a pile of bricks in the middle. They cleaned off the streets and then piled it in the middle of each block. So here would be one square block with the street able to be traveled, but in the center, a huge pile of rubble. And the Germans immediately went to cleaning the mortar off of bricks and starting to rebuild, which I guess put everybody to work.
Now, you left Berlin in December of 45, is that what you said?
Yep. Van Norden was a very rich kid from New York. His dad owned shipping all over the world, and I used to kid him when we were in the foxhole together. That's when you open up and you talk, just to stay awake, if nothing else, and to have something to do. Well, he was telling me one time, 1939, he dated Brenda Fraser, who was debutante of the year. Back in those days, that was the big thing. Well, Life magazine carried a big layout on it and so forth. Well, here's this guy from New York, 7 West 52nd Street, dated Brenda Fraser, debutante of the year for the whole United States. And I said, well, you do that, you're not just a coal miner or anything. And I kidded him so much, he finally said, if you don't say anything to the other fellows, I'll tell you about it. And I'll tell you about my life. And his dad was ultra rich. The kids went to private school. The chauffeur drove them down to school every morning, but the kids got in to stop a block from the school. Then they would get out and walk to school. The chauffeur would follow along slowly on the street to make sure they got into the building. They took a world cruise one time. The chauffeur went along, the doctor, and two nursemaids, or whatever they're called. And it took them a whole year to get around the world. But I've gone to see him a couple of times. He married a woman that worked at Tiffany's in New York. But while we were still in France, or in Bavaria, in this cafe and chalet that the four of us were in, he met a German girl, and there was non-fraternization going on then. You couldn't talk to the Germans or do anything with them. But he fell in love with a German girl and found out that her dad was in shipping, that her dad and his dad knew each other. Well, he said, I'm going to go home, I'll get a diamond, I'll be back, and we're going to get married. He got home, and he started fishing in Alaska and hunting in British Columbia, fishing in South America, and really enjoying himself. And 3 years went by, and he remembered he hadn't gone back, so he got a diamond and went back there. And he found her, but she had married a major in the army, and they were living in Switzerland at the time.
German major or American major?
American major.
Okay.
Van Norden died in 2002 on October 2nd. And I was supposed to do the eulogy for him, but my wife and I were in Côte d'Ivoire in France at the time I got notice that he died, and I couldn't get back here in that time. But they had one of the sons. I wrote it up and then sent it, and they had the son give the eulogy at the funeral.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. McMorrow, for your time today.